Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Welcome to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. I believe I see a few new faces here among the familiars. Who is here for their first Philosophy Forum Lecture? Anybody? No new timers? I thought I saw a few new faces. Maybe just hadn't been in a while. There you go. What brought you out tonight?
Me.
Oh, that's a good way to bring your friends here. Share the pleasure. We are somewhat of a unique organization in several respects, one in which is that we have an all-volunteer staff. We have absolutely no paid positions, and yet we have been for 40 or so years doing more or less the same format. If it ain't broke, why change it? And another unique thing about us is that while most organizations are formed with a mission that has to do with a particular ideological point of view, we are only for the purpose of exposing people who are interested in hearing to as wide an array of viewpoints and ideas as possible, in the belief that we can make our own judgments being exposed to a lot of different alternatives. And I think that really sets us apart as an organization from a lot of folks. So most of you probably know the drill, but we'll have lecture for maybe 45 to 60 minutes, asking you to hold your questions during that time. Then we'll have a moderated Q&A period leading up until about 10 till 9. They want us to clear the room by 9 o'clock so they can shut down. And make sure you they find you with your food ticket before you leave, so that doesn't get absorbed out of our meager budget. And Rob Olson is sitting in the treasurer's chair tonight. And if you didn't get a chance to pay him your contribution of $5 or $2 if you're a student on the way in, you can do it on the way out. And if you want to be a long-term subscriber, you can get close to a half-price deal for signing up 6 months at a time. So I think that's kind of all the administrative business. So I'm going to turn to the
volunteer. Volunteer?
Yeah. Because we are all volunteers, we can always use fresh blood in that capacity. So if you like what this organization does and want to be of assistance in putting on the program, see me or Ken Souter here, or Rob, or Skip, or David. We are the board members here. And tell us about your interest, and we will gladly put you to work.
Silence your cell phone.
And please silence your cell phone so we don't have unwanted interruptions. So with that, I'll turn to the delights of the evening. Our speaker tonight, I mentioned about our wide variety. As far as I can remember, and I've been doing this for 20 years or so, we have never had a PhD geologist address this forum, and so tonight will be a first for that. But interestingly, the topic is not geology. And to explain that, I have been asked to take a little bit of an extended introduction here from our normal biographical introduction we do, and play the role more or less of a straight man to do a little bit of setup on the context of this talk. So so I will try to fulfill that role here as assigned. So as I mentioned, Jeffrey Levine, tonight's speaker. He got his PhD in geology from Penn State. Those guys with the kind of dull-looking uniforms that don't put the names on their backs, but they still managed to win some games. After graduating, Dr. Levine did what most geologists do and went to work in the energy industry. He specializes in coal and petroleum geology. There are other kind of geologists, but the petroleum guys tend to make the most money, so they probably just wouldn't go there. Mr. Levine has published a few papers. He says he could have done more had his interests not been so wide-ranging. And I think you'll probably get to hear a little bit about that tonight. He was rocking along doing what geologists do, serving as a consultant and an employee in the energy extraction industry with fossil fuels until the year 2007, when there was a watershed event. And that event was when Dr. Levine was asked by one of his colleagues to serve on a newly formed committee of the American Association of Petroleum Geologists, that's AAPG for you acronym lovers, and this committee would be called the Global Climate Change Committee. And Dr. Levine accepted this appointment, knowing really not very much one way or the other about climate change, but he figured they had selected him from this job because of his commitment to critical thinking and his low tolerance for BS. Both of which he thought were vitally needed by this committee. And so the committee's task was to be a clearinghouse for information and a focus of dialogue within the geological community regarding anthropogenic global warming, another acronym, AGW. And in the course of serving on this committee, Dr. Levine ran for the first time into a phenomenon that he has termed, along with others, AGW, or anthropogenic global warming denialism. If one of the things probably this committee didn't realize is that they had proven the connection between the subject of climate change and storms, because there were some tempestuous stormy discussions on that committee. And that those storms resulted because of the clash between committee members in the camp in which Dr. Levine presents himself as being those interested in science for science's sake and the integrity of the answer, and then another group whose mission seemed to be to expose corruption and incompetence within the climate science community and to expose those nefarious organizations such as the U.S. National Academy of Science, the Royal Society of London, and others from their invidious agendas. These conflicts were not resolved and led to the sunsetting of the Climate Change Committee after 3 years of stormy activity. It is now 10 years later, and Dr. Levine is more and more convinced about the scientific evidence for AGW, and nevertheless, the phenomenon of AGW denialism has not abated. But the talk, as I understand it, will go broader than just climate change denialism and talk about the emergence of a broader social trend, which has been called, I know one of my favorites, Ken Wilber uses this term, the post-truth era. So he's going to talk a little bit about what the post-truth era means and how that relates to the more specific topic of AGW denialism. And so this has affected Dr. Levine to such an extent that he now directs the better part of his time and efforts to understanding the nature and origin of this kind of denial, post-truth phenomenon, and explores effective means of combating them. And so he will be speaking to us tonight, presenting a talk entitled The Truth About Belief and How It Can All Go So Terribly Wrong. So please join us in welcoming Dr. Jeffrey Levine.
Yeah, I was interestingly nominated to this committee. I really didn't feel confident with my lack of expertise in climate change, climate science. But that was, I think everyone else in the committee but one faced the same impediment. We had one legitimate climate science researcher on the committee, very well-known guy who happens now to be president of my graduate alma mater, Penn State. His name is Eric Barron. He was here in Texas for a while as the dean of the major colleges there. He's directed several major agencies, had a huge career for himself, and he was the only one in that committee who really had experience working with the data. There was another group of people who had no experience, but yet felt that they knew all they needed to know about it. And I, who am constantly feeling intimidated in the inadequate as far as my knowledge about subject areas would spend days researching issues before I felt confidence to discuss them. And there were just things, because I noticed things. I mean, I just noticed things. And there were some things that I noticed about how certainly people tend to approach these issues. So this phenomenon is it's not just a quirky aspect of human psychology. It's a very dangerous phenomenon. When people are discussing this, they discuss it in terms of our possibility of degenerating into an authoritarian government where a relatively small group of people are controlling information, a society that is increasingly disconnected from the concept of truth in general. So there's some very pressing aspects of this, and this is almost a, it is a case study in how this can happen. I brought a little book with me that I really recommend. I want to show it to you if you can find it. Doesn't look like I can right now. It was written by a faculty member at MIT about, he's in the philosophy department, and, oh, here it is. It's just called Post-Truth. It's a little short, very readable book on their MIT Press Essential Knowledge series. And reading this book, it was like, it was a joy for me and also very frustrating, because there was nothing in here that I haven't been following up on over the past few years, but it's been overwhelming. I'll get to that in a second, because to understand this phenomenon, you have to understand not only science and scientific method, and specific science related to climate science, but you have to understand the nature of human psychology and a number of other disciplines. So this is the challenge we face. The next slide. So a fair bit of my time tonight is going to be spent talking about something potentially dry and boring, except I find it fascinating, the meaning of words, because this is such an impediment to communication and to understanding of these issues, where people are using different words in different ways. And there are a lot of commonly used words that are agonizingly difficult to define, and you've got to get on the same page as far as the meaning of the words you're using, or it's impossible to communicate. Did the problems? Is there a pointer? I don't really need one. But do ambiguities in the definition? Some of these concepts are intuitive, related in some mysterious way to the way of human cognition and intelligence evolved through time. Where they really can't be independently defined. Some terms are both used.
Okay. You push them forward and give you a laser pointer.
It doesn't even show up as well as my arrow, so that's okay, thank you.
All right.
And examples of some of these terms that I'm going to be referring to are the word truth, fact, reality, proof, evidence, and knowledge. And if you're into epistemology at all in philosophy, then you'll know that each of these words has been the subject of debate for a few thousand years now, and without resolution. But it's important, nevertheless, to know what people thought about it. So, and I'll be discussing this term, anthropogenic global warming or climate change, which is just confusing, and especially this word belief, which is in my title. The truth about belief, because it is, of all things, probably the most problematic of the terms relating to epistemology. Okay, so if you look up these terms in the dictionary, you immediately run into this problem of circular definitions. If you look up truth, it'll say that it's in accordance with fact and reality. If you look up fact, you find that it's a thing that is known to be proved or true. Well, here's circular reference back there. If you look up that word, proved, it says to prove something is to demonstrate its truth. reality appeared up this one. Reality is a thing that exists in fact. They all refer to each other. And yet somehow, through all this, we're able to use these words in a meaningful way. They're on, referred to all the time on the news. When people talk about waiting for the Mueller report so that people can see the facts of the matter and the truth, they assume that there is such a thing and that everyone kind of knows what that is. In detail, and this is where philosophy has muddied the water a bit, when you really drill down and try to understand these terms, they become increasingly difficult to understand. But one of the most important aspects of what I'll be discussing is that we all share a sense that there is such a thing as truth. And what that actually implies is pretty important from the standpoint of science and from the standpoint of our living together in a shared society. And that's the concept that there is a single external objective reality that we all share. Without that assumption, science would not be possible, and communication would be very difficult. So the fact that these terms are all sort of intuitive actually tells us something. Now, I will talk about how my concept, my feeling how cognition and human intelligence evolved in response to evolutionary processes, evolutionary pressure, and those processes provided an advantage to people who weren't delusional, who could receive sensory input and information from their environment, draw reasonable conclusions, and use those conclusions to increase their presence in the gene pool and propagate that skill through time. So this is frustrating, but it does say something that's important about a human cognition and intelligence. So about this term, anthropogenic global warming, I use this term AGW, and it's a problem because people who are trying to obfuscate the issues often make a really silly, stupid argument that we used to talk about global warming, and now we talk about climate change, supposedly to hide the fact that the Earth stopped warming, which it actually never did. But these terms basically mean the same thing. The primary process here is, and I'm not going to discuss the evidence for climate change in detail. The only thing I want to say about it is if you spend the time, as I have done, in a sincere and earnest effort to understand that the evidence for it is extremely strong. We don't have to wonder whether this process is happening. It's a complex system. There are things going on that we can't fully explain yet, but we know enough right now to know that it is happening. And if any of you have questions about that, you can maybe ask me at the end, but it would take way too long to go through all the arguments supporting it. Okay, so the warming, which is the primary process, this is the enhanced retention of outgoing infrared or heat radiation, that warming at various levels of the atmosphere is what causes climate change. Climate change is sort of a response. Climate is inherently a noisy system. By definition, climate is a 20 or 30 year average weather, although it's hard to apply that definition rigorously because our climate is changing so rapidly now that if you wait 30 years to show it, you're losing precious time. So anyway, that's what the meaning of these terms is. I include the word anthropogenic or human caused as part of that term because it is. That is sort of begs the question in a way. I could accept that criticism, but not to use that term is to avoid what is ultimately the real issue. And by that, we're talking primarily about the warming that has taken place throughout the 20th century, continuing it into the 21st century. So I hope that's always clear, and quote from Shakespeare, what's the name? That which we call a rose by any other word would smell as sweet. Yes, but if you have a rose and everyone can smell it, then that's sort of self-evident. But if you have a term like climate,
for A to W, it becomes more important that the meaning of those things be understood. Okay, this issue about, I didn't mean, okay, from current slide, I'm sorry. No, I know not to do that again. Okay, this issue about AGW, people who want to argue about it want to make it a scientific issue. And if you tell them, no, we really need to understand human psychology. We need to understand the role that value-based beliefs, including those that come from politics, religion, and social norms, what role these things play. What can we learn from cognitive neuroscience as far as what parts of our brain are most active under certain circumstances with confronted with the kind of information we're dealing with here. We have to tap into what's understood about epistemology. This, to me, is like the time for philosophers to shine. I mean, philosophers on front stage and center, and I don't quite see that happening. And there's been a bit of a problem, I think, in philosophy over centuries now that are becoming a little bit too insular and esoteric. But this is certainly an area where applied philosophy becomes really important. And I also want to talk about how and why does science work. And this is also very important to understand. And I'll jump ahead and give away my conclusion. The people who are arguing that anthropogenic global warming is at best exaggerated, maybe not happening at all, and at worst an intentional hoax, those people have forsaken scientific method, and they'll deny that because they claim that they're the only ones who are doing science right. But they are explicitly saying that the system is corrupted. It's maybe irretrievably corrupted. We know that because the science community has told us that anthropogenic global warming is happening when we know damn well it isn't. So that's how serious it is. And this willingness to throw science under the bus in pursuit of some other hidden agenda, and an agenda that is hidden even from their own consciousness, is a really bad thing. And just to tie this together with the post-truth stuff, we are confronting the same thing with these relentless attacks on the media. And this has been part of an ongoing effort, and it's been politically motivated, and it goes back really to the 60s with the attacks on elitism and anti-intellectualism that began, that could be seen in society all the way back then. And then aggressively, starting in the 70s through the 80s, about the so-called liberal media, and you couldn't trust them. And now this has taken on absurd proportions with nonstop attacks on the liberal media. And I don't know how many of you watch Fox News. I watch occasionally. And the thing that strikes me about it more than anything is not the truth or falseness of things they're reporting, but their relentless attacks on the liberal media. It's like everything is couched in those terms. There's a concerted effort to try to undermine our collective shared trust in the traditional sources of authoritative information in our society. And that is a frightening prospect, because we need to trust what the scientists are telling us about anthropogenic global warming, and about lots of other things. And the message each day is these groups are not to be trusted. Okay, I'm going to stop trying to decide which slides to skip through, because as usual, I run on a little bit too much. I'm going to make a couple references in here to the usefulness, utility of competitive selection as an efficacious, successful method of producing I'll say good results. So the good has a normative component to it that I don't mean to imply. I mean successful results. And one of the ways has to do when I start talking about human cognition a little bit and how it has led us into the situation we're in right now is that we can infer that, and it's subject to all the limitations of inference as a method of reasoning, it might be wrong. It's based on inductive reasoning, which is famously flawed, as David Hume and many others have told us. But we can nevertheless infer that our species has gained a rather remarkable survival advantage by virtue of a change that's taken place over the course of time. And that change has to do with the size and shape of our brains, and particularly the development of the frontal cortex, and you have to understand those things. And the other areas of brain function is quite fascinating now, the kind of studies they're doing to link certain activity in certain areas of the brain with certain types of situations when people are presented with information that they find disquieting, disturbing, create cognitive dissonance. So our brain is heavily involved in this, and I'll skip a little poem. I love this little thing. I'll just read the first three lines. All creatures strive, the fit survive, out of this surge species emerge, throw the bum out, as nature shouts. So through this process, we've been selecting for certain capabilities through time. So there's been a long history of hominid evolution. The most recent fossil record was of a variety of human, proto-human, was identified as Cro-Magnon man. It turns out they are us. They are essentially us in terms of brain size and shape. They are apparently not different from us in terms of their capabilities. One of the incredible things about this evolutionary process of developing cognitive function is that these people who were painting these pictures on cave walls, and we don't even know what their language skills were, they may have had powers of reasoning very nearly equal to that of our own. And it's stunning that in the savannah in Africa, that these naked apes could develop this phenomenal function. This was supposed to be a joke because it's showing that it actually maybe regressed in terms of our history. This was not a joke. It's really serious. I mean, it spears then, and we have other stuff now. And to make this happen required a level of abstract thinking and synthesis of knowledge that was really quite remarkable. Okay, so we can just look at what are the apparent benefits. And there are two categories, and this is kind of my spin on things. I suspect this is in the literature somewhere. And one of them is related to our rational thinking processes, and the other has to do with our social bonding capabilities. So there are aspects of human brain function that are specifically aimed at building successful communities, and that certainly is one of the things that has contributed to our success. Even today, I mean, the fact that we can build communities like Dallas that work, I mean, sometimes we're pretty disgruntled with that it doesn't work very efficiently at times, but it works. I mean, we have 6 million people in this one area, and everything that goes on to make this work, it's amazing. And this had its roots back in the savannah of Africa. The ability to correctly perceive, interpret, understand, and predict the behavior of elements of the natural world would enhance survival potential by enabling individuals to survive better by sharing information. It would enable group survival, and have elements of your genetic code in other members of your tribe as well. And it may have some interplay with the social aspects by, if you were particularly good at this, it could increase your stature and standing in the community. So it's easy to understand how having enhanced rational, logical reasoning capabilities might have been selected for over the course of time. But it's also very clear that having the ability to form strong social groups was also a survival advantage, especially back then. People needed to work together cooperatively to kill the game that they were after, who were faster, bigger, stronger, and everything else than they were. And the types of cognitive traits that contribute to this capability are not necessarily advantageous in terms of cognitive skills. And we're seeing that today, where group, this has given rise to the phenomenon of tribal epistemology, where commitment to one's group and allegiance to one's fellow tribal members takes precedence over rational thinking. So part of the frustration you might feel at someone's seeming unwillingness or inability to think rationally about these scientific issues is related to this. And this gives rise to cognitive bias, which is down the road, I'll talk about the psychological aspects of this. Okay. Now, epistemology was one of the things that was listed, and I just want to go through, I mean, this is a really deep topic. It's very complex, very difficult, but it just refers to the study or theory of the nature and grounds of knowledge. Like, how do we acquire knowledge? What is it based on? How do we justify the things we purport to know? It's a relatively recent word, but the roots of it, the questions that were being asked back in Plato's Academy and by Socrates and the other Platonic, pre-Socratic, okay, even back then. So they were definitely understood, these concepts and ideas. I love the analogy, the metaphor of Plato's cave, where he hypothesized a situation where people could not see, directly perceive reality, but just a image of reality. And so he clearly understood that we had limited capacity to perceive the very real aspects of the world. And this is another joke. the basic view hasn't advanced that much, but that's basically, and Feyerabend was one of the influential people in the postmodernism movement, which also plays into the post-truth era. And it's not that postmodernism hasn't contributed some useful ideas, but it was probably more disruptive than beneficial, especially when things got a little extreme. But the point is, and I left out obviously a lot of people in between Plato and Paul Feyerabend, so there are definitely some useful contributions made. I'm going to go back and talk about Francis Bacon if I have time. Just his contributions alone were immensely beneficial, and yet the epistemological questions are not yet answered. So one of the things that we need to do in trying to make this entire line of inquiry useful is to say, we'll set aside a certain category of questions for philosophers and epistemologists to continue to work on, but we've got to go with something more pragmatic in the short term. And that's definitely possible, and I won't talk about how I think that might be possible. Alright, so it's this term, a lot of these terms, you can't imagine how obvious terms like this, I didn't really have a really good, strong, clear understanding on what these terms meant. But the concept about when I first started this project, but I had to learn what they meant. And the concept of objectivity is describing the features of the world as it exists outside of our mind. It's an externalist notion. It's a not based on idealism or other epistemological models, but it implies this notion of a single external objective reality that we all share. And this is what enables scientific collaboration, for example. Climate science has been very much an international effort. There have been contributions from scientific teams all over the world. If they were dealing with a different set of scientific laws or reality in their countries, they couldn't combine data sets. And so we're able to collaborate internationally in science because of this presumption. Now, this is actually, if you're into epistemology, one of the underlying assumptions associated with foundationalism. It's something we cannot prove, but without which we cannot progress. So it is something we have to presume, and I'm happy to do that, because the success science has had by making this presumption is, you know, how large does your data set have to be before you can say, this is proved? Yet, from a strictly logical argument standpoint, it is nevertheless an assumption. This is just an expansion on what I was saying before, that this objective reality is shared by all. It's something capable, it's being perceived, it's perceptible by experience, it's describable using language, it's measurable, and when scientists discuss reality, this is what they're talking about. Other people in society may have a broader concept of reality than science does, but science restricts its ontological domain to a certain category of phenomena. And these are the phenomena that comprise the physical universe, the stuff that we can see, and it's measurable in some way. And the interactions between elements of that physical universe provide the basis for scientific laws, and that's what we're describing. It specifically excludes supernatural things. It's a bit circular, the argument, but it describes things that are not everyday activities. According to scientific laws, there's a certain repetitiveness and predictability in the behavior of things in the universe, and these things take place whether or not we're aware of them. You can look over that list quickly. I'm going to rest my voice for just a second, and I think I've said most of these things. Part down at the bottom, uniformitarianism. That's something that actually came out of geology. And it has to do with the kind of scientific reasoning. When I get to talking about scientific method, there's a lot of misunderstanding what scientific method is or entails. And one of the common understandings is that it must involve setting up controlled experiments that are repeatable, and then you measure the results, compile them, and write them up, and have people look at them, if possible, replicate your results. Geological reasoning is not based on, it's based on a completely different principle, and a completely different type of reasoning that is called abductive reasoning. And it's because the geological phenomena that we're looking at form and occurred in response to processes that took place millions of years ago. And in order for us to have any hope of understanding what processes might may have formed those geological features, we need to assume that the same basic laws of physics occurred millions of years ago as occur today. Astrophysicists make the same assumption about the origin of the universe, and they can trace everything back to the singularity that preceded the Big Bang, and not any further back. But it nevertheless assumes that certain fundamental physical laws have persisted through time. There are things that fall outside the realm of scientific inquiry. We still are struggling with the nature and origin of consciousness. What happens to things when they die? I mean, these are fascinating questions. And they traditionally fall within the domain of religion. I would like to explain for those of you who are familiar with the term, I'm an accommodationist, unapologetic, and that puts me at odds with some people who are really committed to the concept of religious belief just not being a justifiable viewpoint and without any evidence. But I'm fine with it because I can't disprove those beliefs, so why should I pretend that I can? We tend to rely a lot on our windows on the universe, although not exclusively, because we can translate with the interactions between different elements, we can translate things that we can directly perceive. Okay, so the project of epistemology can never be successful. And it can never be successful because we can never know everything. We can never know everything, but that doesn't mean we know nothing, and that's very important. But I don't think we should be obsessed with trying to find some rule that applies to everything in all situations, as has been the obsession of epistemology for at least the last couple hundred years, because there's a way around it, and the way around it is through statistics, and particularly Bayesian statistics. Because it is a statistical universe that we live in, and we're constrained to dealing with all the complex systems that we're looking at in a statistical manner. We can do no better than to generate statistical likelihoods of certain things occurring. And when you get down to quantum scale phenomenon, it becomes even stranger. So I think any hope of coming up with a absolute knowledge of absolute truth is a fool's errand. So I think we can forget that. Now this actually has implications when I get back to discussing belief. I don't think there is a concept of belief and truth being distinct concepts in epistemology. And I think the concept of truth is a bit of a chimera. We can never get there, so why do we even have a name for it? When all we can ever do is the best we can with the information we have. And that's fine. That's good enough. So I think science can move us in the right direction. Okay, here, how has truth manifest itself to us in the human intellect? And I took out besides talking about the Stephen Jay Gould's concept of non-overlapping magisteria, which I see nothing wrong with. He got this term directly from the Catholic Church, and he got it while he was invited to the Vatican to teach them about evolution, which they completely incorporated into their understanding of the universe. I mean, there's things that they say that they probably don't have justification or warrant to say, but at least on some basic science questions, they've accommodated themselves to that there are scientific facts out there. And within this magisterium, that of the physical universe where scientists live, these are some of the ways that we can form understanding. And I don't really have time to discuss this any further, but it pretty much describes the limits of what we can potentially do. Now, I want to return to this concept of truth. And I mentioned earlier that somehow through natural selection, that our cognitive capabilities developed this intuitive sense that there was something called truth out there. And one of the interesting clues to this, that so far as I know, I couldn't find any other reference to it on the internet, on Google when I searched, is the fact that truth takes a definite article, the truth, whereas the expression lie takes an indefinite article. So there are potentially many lies, but there's only one truth. I mean, that, and I started writing to people, I found a discussion of this on, I don't remember if it was on Quora, or it might have been, where people were contributing stuff from different countries. I got a disappointing return. I got return from one guy in Nepal. The question was, in your language, do you use the definite article for truth and indefinite article? So far, in my very small sample population, we're at 100%. I'm interested to follow up on it, because I think it also is a clue to this innate sense that we have. And that innate sense extends to other venues like courts of law. And we know that things don't come stamped with a stamp that says truth. We realize it's up to us to decide. In a legal context, there are specific parties in the court who are in charge with that duty responsibility. If it's a jury trial, it's a jury. If it's heard by a judge, then it's the judge. And within that conceptual domain, that is what truth is. And I worked as a expert witness in a number of court cases that I loved doing. I just loved it. But there was a point where I had just a crisis of when I realized that attorneys had a little bit of a different concept. I had a sort of idealized notion of truth. I was still kind of wedded to this idea that scientists are have the capacity to find absolute truth, which is not true for us any more than it is for lawyers. But in law, it might be a little more malleable than science, but I'm not sure. Okay, skip that. Okay, this is a difficult topic, and I'm going to skip over it. There are certain philosophical concepts of belief, but the one I really want to get to is the vernacular usage of the word truth. So I get these crazy ideas to try to get ideas across. Okay. I got the idea of a streetcar named Desire, and I created this streetcar line in New Orleans, an authentic New Orleans streetcar, and this one's called the streetcar named Objective Reality. And this streetcar has a strange route characteristic. At every stop it makes, its next trip is halfway towards its destination. And in New Orleans, they name the streetcars for the end of the line. So streetcar named Desire ends on Desire Avenue, whatever that is. But this one's headed to Objective Reality. But initially, the steps are big. Later on, the steps are smaller. But it never gets there. It never gets there. But you do know the direction you're going. You're going toward truth, and this is what science aspires to. And that's why I put an advertisement for scientific method on the side. Because this is how, literally, how science works. The difference in the vernacular usage, especially for people who aren't maybe so committed to scientific method as I am, is that truth can apply to things that are extend beyond the physical world and to the other magisterium, which is the domain of God. And what's my time? I'm terribly afraid.
That's right. It is 8:19, so you probably got about 15 more minutes.
Okay. All right. So there's that problem, for one. And And you can't distinguish the two. I don't think that people who have this, who have these magisteria overlapping, make any distinction between the things they believe to be true or hold to be true in the context of the religious beliefs and things that they hold to be true and things based on evidence. As a matter of fact, if there's a hierarchy there, it may well be that they place higher priority and authority to the to their religious beliefs. I had a slide here that showed this. I think I took it out just because it was too much. But it was from a web page where someone was talking about the inerrancy of the Bible, and that in no uncertain terms, it says that the Bible is clear, unambiguous, and only source of truth. But I found this one interesting. This is one of my forays in trying to find out what these words meant in a dictionary standpoint, from a dictionary definition. And these are two very widely cited dictionaries online. Merriam-Webster's, they define the conviction of belief, is defined as the conviction of truth of some statements or the reality of some being or phenomenon, especially when based on examination of evidence. And that's how we most often use that. Then the Oxford Dictionary says an acceptance that something exists is true, especially one without proof. Well, I mean, so we have some quirky differences between British English and American. But this speaks to a more fundamental problem. And my way of resolving it is that, in fact, the word belief implies either one or both. It does not specify. And my understanding of the word belief is something you basically hold to be true, whether it's based on evidence or not. And that's how we use that term on an everyday term. And scientists use it. Some people like to think the word belief ought to be restricted only to things that are based on faith. And that is just, to me, not only not true, it's very much inflates the actual epistemic foundation of their own beliefs. Because when you really look at these things in detail, there are assumptions down there that are, that's when you get down to the assumptions that have to be made for foundationalism. So that is my understanding. Okay, now you have this concept of belief, knowledge, and warrant that I also don't have time to spend, and there's a lot of stuff on this. And the notion of belief is beliefs we all recognize can be wrong. I mean, they can be wrong, but we like to reserve a special place of honor to beliefs that are actually true. But you can't just say that they're true without backing it up, and the backup comes in the form of justification. And what's the other word I came across? No, there was another word for warrant. Warrant is what you have to add to this to basically justify the justification. And it gets into these very long, convoluted discussions of people who reach the right conclusion for the wrong reason, so they can't be said to have knowledge because even though they were right, they weren't right because they thought it through properly. They were just lucky. So this is an unending argument, maybe unresolvable like anything else in epistemology. But I think this is a place, again, where statistical likelihood can provide a way out. Because even if we can't provide a perfect warrant for the truth of our beliefs, we can probably apply a statistical likelihood. And I just need to work on my Bayesian statistics to where I'm really fluent in it, because I don't have enough experience of actually using it, but I'm pretty sure that when I do, that's going to be where I'm comfortable, because it seems like all of science is moving in that direction. Okay, So the notion of science is that, I'm going to skip the slide. I don't think it's it doesn't have that much. Now, these two slides, I'm very proud of. I did this one, and I'll show you another one next. It was the first one I did. I did this one just like last week, and it shows the normal track, the normal arc of science through, as related. So on the bottom axis, it's qualitative. It's the strength of evidence from weak to strong. And then on the vertical axis is confidence or certainty, which relates to the Bayesian statistics, that the priors and your data, if you have it on what new information you have. But normally, it progresses along this line. The stronger your evidence, and the more evidence you have, which would affect the confidence, that you move progressively in this direction of truth. And I tried to show that you don't get there, but you get closer and closer. But you also have these positions that fall off of that trend. And if you're kind of curmudgeonly and just want to be a contrarian in a way, and you, in a reasonable way, want to raise a skeptical view toward the information you've been given, then you can say, I'm not that certain as you are. So that's the vertical difference between this line and this line, is just given the same amount of evidence, I'm not convinced. That's a perfectly valid scientific viewpoint. Science relies on it in some ways, and this would be the foundation for valid criticism or skepticism regarding anthropogenic global warming. On the other side is an excessive, unwarranted level of trust, and we tend to have that on people who are maybe influenced by certain biases against the source of the our problem, CO2, the energy companies who are generally hated. And they may not have any real technical understanding of the science underlying anthropogenic global warming at all, but they believe it's true. But this is the one that I want to talk about because it's an important phenomenon here. And what it shows is even as the strength of evidence progressively increases, it represents a position that superficially resembles skepticism. But what it really is, if you look at it carefully, is a simple rejection of the conclusion that you're working toward along this green line here. And this word denialism is controversial. Every time I use it on Quora or online, somebody gets on my case that this is, I'm not even going to answer you because you use that word, because they associate it with Holocaust denial. And they should, because it, although the subject, the object of the denial is vastly different, the methodology and the motivations are very similar. In fact, the first time I encountered the term denialism used in a more generic sense to refer not only to Holocaust denial, but all sorts of other denial was on a Holocaust remembrance website. And oddly, that article's been taken down, which I don't know if I've an archived copy of it or not, but it was a very good article, and for some reason it's gone. So, the example up here is to say the first time some people heard that, you know, that goddamn oil companies were causing global warming, they were completely believed it, and they've never changed. So this is where a good scientist should track, and this is what I claim legitimate climate scientists have done. And this is what people who are down here on this track deny has been done. And the basis for their denial is what tells us that they started off in this track. This pertains to the next diagram, which I'm not going to show. And it basically shows a very similar thing. And I just thought that a diagram I came up with showed this in more detail. I just happened to spend like 8 hours working on this, so it's a little bit more colorful, but it basically is showing the same thing. But what it's emphasizing more is that there's a range of skepticism within any science track, and there should be, and that's important. So true science is not a narrowed line. It's not just a series of points. It's a band of healthy skepticism associated with it. So that's basically what we're doing. It. The other thing I want to point out on this diagram and this one is, you see the little pop graphic there? The nihilism actually doesn't manifest itself until very late in this data collection process. Now, you need to know the concept underlying anthropogenic global warming, that CO2 might cause an increased retention of heat in the atmosphere, was proposed in 1896. And it was based on spectroscopic data that was even older. And it was proposed by Arrhenius, a Swiss chemist, but it wasn't proved. It was a plausible hypothesis. And it's been 100 years in the works, in science, before scientists felt, we've got the data now. This not only can't happen, it's happening. And it was just at that time, right when the scientists felt confident enough to say, we think this is happening, that suddenly this entire shadow community of people who said, no, it's not happening, suddenly appeared. Now, one of the big questions is how much did the fossil fuels industry cause that to happen at the time? There were economic incentives at the time. It was the time that they were negotiating the Tokyo Kyoto Protocols and... sorry, we're running out of time.
Five minutes max.
Okay, I'm going to go away from my slides and just try to finish up the things I want to say. I was going to just mention Bacon because the guy was brilliant. I mean, he was just brilliant. He came up with these idols that are impediments to clear understanding. And he identified different categories of these. They don't hold up perfectly well, but he understood that scientists were, like anybody else, subject to biases. And when he used the term idol, he's referring to cognitive bias. I mean, that's the term we use now. And especially, idol to the child didn't mean it the way we mean it now. He meant shortcomings that were inherent in human nature. But he recognized that we are born into the world with certain predisposition not to think rationally about issues. So if we are looking at complex scientific questions, we have to be very keenly aware of our potential for falling victim to that. Now, here's another point where I want to talk about natural selection again, because this is how science works really. Scientific theories are evolved. It's not a smooth or well thought out or seamless process, but basically ideas are thrown out, and the ones that go through the sieve, that's not failure, that's good if it goes through the sieve, are the ones that have predictive power. And just like in natural selection, you can't predict if I would have a child that had a rooster comb on his head, that would be probably wouldn't be a selective advantage. But you don't know, you can't predict, but you can retrodict what characteristics enabled a particular species to survive. And that's what we speculated about in human evolution. And so there are constantly new ideas being thrown out. I have a little anecdote that has to do with Galileo and this weird guy who used to wander around the building at the University of Alabama while I was working, who had this theory, he was a physicist, that the sun was hollow. And he just showed me pages and pages of differential equations and mathematics to prove this crazy theory. I couldn't figure out head or tail of it. He was obviously believed that, and you obviously have never heard of the guy. And there's a sense that the moment Copernicus said that the sun is the center of the solar system, that came with a flashing light from God saying, fact, certified fact. That's not the way science works. It was accepted because it stood the test of time. Okay, I'm wrapping up right now. What we're facing with this phenomenon of denialism is people who are motivated by these relict behaviorisms in their brains that have been involved in the success, but also in some ways the failure of the human species. And some of them are related to social psychology, some of them are related to individual psychology, but they all basically come down to what's termed cognitive dissonance. When people hear stuff that is upsetting to them because it's inconsistent with things that they believe about their tribe or about themselves, they don't want to believe it, and they'll start looking around for ways of rejecting it. And that's exactly what they do. And they think that they're uncovering the hoax, the bad science, and what they're doing is putting out a lot of bad science out there. And this is all in an effort to alleviate and relieve their cognitive dissonance. And it's just called motivated bias, motivated reasoning, and it's very obvious. One final point, I'll be done. I've identified, just by looking, who are the denialists on the internet? There are four social communities who have an incentive for reasons of cognitive dissonance, relieving cognitive dissonance. They have an incentive for rejecting the concept of anthropogenic climate change. Those four groups are social conservatives, libertarians, evangelical Christians, and people associated with the petroleum industry. And not everyone in any of those groups, not everyone is a denialist. But I've never met a denialist who wasn't in one or four more of those groups. And I think it might be already clear what the incentive is for each of those groups. I didn't know enough about evangelical Christianity to know what the issues are, but there are issues there. They have definitely religious-based reasons for not liking this idea, and they've been one of the most prominent forces. I actually feel that the petroleum industry, at least in terms of the people actually out fighting the battle, are the least influential of all the four groups. All the other four groups are much larger in population. Now, the petroleum industry may have had their influence to large financial contributions to the Cato Institute or to the Heritage Foundation or whatever. I don't know. That's hard to say. I just know that these other four groups all have been very active. So that's basically my talk, and thank you very much for your attention.
Who's the author of that book?
Oh, this? His name is Lee McIntyre. I really recommend it. It's so nicely written. I was jealous because I thought, I could have done that. But no, he did it. And I was candid about my lack of productivity in putting this stuff. But it also reassured me. He's talking about the same issues that I've been interested in and concerned about. And I think I pretty much have this stuff covered. My next step is to figure out how can I get this out to people who need to hear it. So you're the first group I'm actually speaking public to, so you have that distinction. Probably a relatively friendly group, but it's still important.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions, so we have a question right here.
Yeah, I often wondered also, you mentioned evangelicals as being one of the groups that tends to be called a liar. And one of the things I've often wondered about, when you get an answer to it, is why?
Why?
What is there about the evangelical?
Well, there are a few. For one thing, all of those groups already
have strong allegiance with the conservative Republican Party. And people tend to stick to the tribe that they self-identify with. I don't think that's particularly important. Second thing is, evangelicals have a very strongly felt belief of an active interventionist God who looks over mankind and takes care, helps to fix problems, and it's what they believe. And I think the notion of God allowing this to happen, conceivably, is some of the worst case scenario, say, resulting in the end of human civilization. You know, I don't like to emphasize it really along these cases, but that's something that is religiously repugnant to them. The other is that they believe that the earth was created for mankind. I've read, there's a statement on the internet, a sort of manifesto, I think they call that, evangelical manifesto, that lists all the reasons, and a lot of them are concerned for the poor and the degree to which poor communities benefit from low-cost fossil fuels. I think it's a legitimate point, a legitimate concern. And finally, the last one is their hostile attitude toward the environmental movement. And they associate the concern about anthropogenic climate change with environmentalism. They regard environmentalism as a false religion, a geo-worshipping, you know, naturalistic kind of religion, and it's sort of like, it's ad hominem, but it's saying, if they're concerned about this, we don't want anything to do with it. So together, all those things are pretty strong. And if you have any other ideas about it,
you left out the part about how they also believe that everything's going to turn to hell, and then the good get to go up to heaven. So you left out about that part.
I'm sorry, I did.
Apocalypse. Yeah. You know, so that's a big thing.
If this brings about the end times, that's part of their
So the good people get to go to heaven.
Well, I don't know if they think it's good, but they're not afraid of it. They're ready. They're ready. And they're going to be on the God.
waiting for this opportunity.
I just want to add one more thing. I forgot. There's this concept in the Book of Revelations of a dichotomy between good and evil. And that final battle of Armageddon will be fought between this army of good and army of evil. And it's a false dichotomy from as a logical fallacy. But they know that they're either on one side or the other. So they put themselves on the good side and put everybody else on the bad side.
It's often thought that people who don't believe in, you know, obvious science are either ignorant or uninformed or even irrational. But during the witch hunt of the late 1700s, early 1800s, 1600s, those people were, you know, the judges were given, you know, volumes, how to judge witches, you know, what the evidence was, the way the evidence. And in more modern times, we have Nazism and its racial, you know, pseudoscientific stuff. So these people are not stupid, and we shouldn't just throw them out and say they're ignorant. A psychology experiment put a subject with several, you know, people that were in the know in a room, and they were presented with, you know, something, and the majority said, you know, that black was white, or just, you know, an obvious error, and convinced the subject, you know, to their side. So the question is, how much of this, you know, denialism is not just psychology but sociological?
Well, it's interesting because if I had time to tell you some anecdotes of my experience on the Global Climate Change Committee on AAPG, I've encountered three PhD geologists scientists, two of them are past presidents of ADG. This is an organization with membership of 40,000 people internationally. Both of them were founders of their own companies, very successful. One of them actually founded a company that specializes in statistical approaches to petroleum exploration, stochastic modeling, using Monte Carlo simulations. So he clearly understands the statistical nature of things. And I'll just tell you his story briefly, because it's almost too much to be believed. I saw that this guy had been named a distinguished lecturer for ADG, and he was going to be giving a lecture, traveling to universities, giving a lecture on the risks of cognitive bias and how people have to be attentive to cognitive bias. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh crap, this isn't about geologists, it's about climate scientists. And sure enough, at the same time, he was also giving another lecture about how climate change is a hoax. So he actually went out and researched the topic of cognitive bias to develop an elaborate rationalization. I think rationalization, it's the one word oxymoron. It's a funny word. It's not rational, that's for sure. But this is what smart people do. They develop more ingenious, more creative ways of finding ways to justify their viewpoints. And I called that guy. I wanted to meet with him. I was going to sit down with him and just talk through these things. He wouldn't do it. Wouldn't meet with me.
Well, at the start of your talk, I knew the question I wanted to ask you, and that was so simple. You talked about Fox News, which I don't watch. Should I watch Fox News and not find out what's going on? But I guess the question is, denial, it's interesting how efficient a minority of people can become, and they can become the majority or tyranny of more of a majority of people. Because I think just today it was revealed that the majority of Americans do believe in climate change, but there is a strong denial or a very efficient machine to make you think that there's an equivalency, that there are equal amount of people in this country who do not believe in climate change, and there are people that do, and they're very strong, they're very, very sophisticated in making that position. And one of the classical things that I hear all the time, they'll say that Americans voted for Donald Trump when the popular vote showed that they did not. American popular vote was never or ever.
That's a question.
And so the question is that's, to me, is how efficient denialism is, or it can be.
It is pervasive. It extends well beyond that specific issue. It has to do with trying to undermine the authority, and ultimately, by the way, this is supposed to be actually a 2 or 3 day short course, so there's so many people to say. But ultimately, as a practical matter, we tend to rely on experts for most of our things. People who we know to provide reliable information. They've specifically been aimed at trying to undermine the authority of people who used to be in that position. And that's the most, that's their number one goal, is to try to undermine that. They generally fall. And the other thing we're going to talk about, in terms of that progression of science through time, it's not just a question of gathering more facts. The underlying epistemology of science is coherentism. It's that there needs to be an interconnection of information. And taken to the extreme, it's the term consilience is used to describe not only within a specific discipline, but other disciplines converging over time in their understanding of the world, developing understandings and ideas
that reinforce one another. And that's how scientific, that's the only way we can find truth. That's the only way we know we're getting closer to the end of the line on the streetcar named objectivity, is when stuff fits together. And they cherry pick examples that they claim don't fit together. They make accusations that are completely outlandish, trying to undermine the credibility of the people who are doing that work. They say that they're motivated only by career self-interest. I'm just horrible things. But part of it is creating a narrative. And all worthy bodies of knowledge are in narrative form. They're built on a congruency and confluence of data and information and ideas that we've been accumulating for hundreds of years. That's why Arrhenius could not have come up with his idea in 1896 if it weren't for the previous work on spectroscopy that had been done in the decades before him. These things all fit together, and they try to do the same thing. Their whole story mimics science. They use the same terminology. They use the same kind of approaches. And that's a creepy part, because they are effectively using the immense success of science and the terms that have come in the common understanding, common usage, to lend themselves credibility. Say, look, we're critical thinkers too.
Last question here. Let's try to keep to a short question.
I'd like for you to comment on something I heard on Public Radio this afternoon. They were talking about truth, and the statement was made that the Russians are counting on the destruction of the belief that there is such a thing as truth, and that we need to focus on building a more truth-resilient society.
It's absolutely true. This is one of the things that the title of this book is Post-Truth. Now, he talks a lot about climate change as sort of a type example of how a group having motivated bias, a particular motivation, were able to create a world in which facts don't matter. I know it's a hackneyed expression, but it literally is what is the case now. What we used to call facts, statements about the world, are now sort of signaling to let other people know that you're in the same team that you are. The truth and falseness is of no significance. So this is a serious matter. He talks about that quite a bit here. It's one of the reasons why I recommend the book.
Okay, thank you. As a token of our appreciation, we'd like to present you with this coffee mug, which has Raphael School of Athens with Plato and Aristotle debating their various worldviews, and recognize you as a featured speaker of the House of Philosophers.